Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Bryson Garrison, 22 years of combination experience, fire chief for Brighton Fire Rescue in Colorado, who made his way through the ranks of the organization. Bryson believes in quality hard work and that individuals who want to be successful in whatever path they choose need to invest within yourself, take it seriously, do your best, and bring it back to your respective organization. Bryson is a prime example of a firefighter's chief who remembers that you need to get out of your office, go out to listen and communicate with the boots on the ground. With that, I present Mr. Bryson Garrison.
Hi, I'm Bryson Garrison, fire chief of Brighton Fire Rescue in Colorado. And talk a little about the first question here is, how did I get in the fire service? And for me personally, I saw a sign that just said looking for volunteers. Had a pretty rewarding job in the corporate sector, and then I just wanted to help out in the community. That was really it. I had grown up near a fire station, so maybe there was some tie into that, seeing the fire crews literally on the corner, cleaning the rigs and running calls. I grew up in an all-volunteer area on the East Coast, but I didn't have a lot of connection to the fire service there. But once I got here and I was looking for a way to get back to the community, I saw that as an opportunity to volunteer, and then I realized, wait a sec, you can also do this as a career. So that's kind of how it started, as a volunteer, and then and just wanted to help in the community. And then from there, my corporate role moved to another state, so I could either take a severance or move to another state. So I took the severance and then worked to become a career firefighter. It took me about a year to do that, and I was hired on as a career firefighter in 2004.
Okay.
So that's
Where was this at?
So this was all at Brighton Fire. So my whole fire service career, for the most part, I'll talk a little bit about some of the travels along the way. But I started in Brighton as a volunteer, became a career firefighter here. And the only reason why I was looking to help in the community. And I thought that might be a place for me to do it. I'm not sure why it resonated with me. I didn't know a whole lot about the fire service at the time. So,
okay.
That was my start.
Okay. Okay. Any other family members or anybody else in the fire service or emergency services world?
I've got military in our background. My grandfather was in the Army. My father was in the Air Force. He had done some work with volunteer peace in the Air Force, and then after that volunteered, but really wasn't something that was in my mind as part of our family history. So the only other connection I've got in the fire service is my brother-in-law was part of FDNY for his whole career and has since retired. So, and while that was part of what I understood at the time, I was still a young person doing my own thing in the world. And it just,
right. So. Right. Okay. So with you being a volunteer before Brighton turned full-time, how was that transition like for the department and for yourself to see that?
Sure. Yeah. It was an interesting time because, before that, we had some career staff, administrative staff. Before I was hired, just shortly, maybe I would say a year or two before, I don't remember the exact timeline, Brighton Fire hired 9 career firefighters. So it was right around 2000, 2001, 2000, somewhere in that kind of ballpark. And then that's kind of how the transition started, from all volunteer to kind of a combination of career and volunteer. And it's always interesting because I think there's always some, I haven't seen at least a transition from volunteer to career where there aren't some feelings that get hurt along the way in that process. And that certainly happened to our organization at the time, where people felt that they had been a major contributor and then felt like they weren't able to contribute at the same level before. And that certainly upset some folks. And we worked through that for quite a long time of that kind of transition until maybe about, gosh, I would say 2016 or 17, I think that was our last volunteer. So about 7-8 years ago, the last volunteer was kind of, that was that. And we transitioned to just all career after that. So that we had a combination for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very strong community, excuse me. We have a very strong community connection to our volunteers and our history. So there's a lot of folks that have been part of the fire department that still live in the community that really like to engage with the fire department. And for a while, I think they felt like they weren't able to do that. So there were some hurt feelings that we've been able to mend a lot of those fences over time. So that's been good. So,
Okay.
yeah.
And I mean, Brighton is not the only department I know to do that. I think the way times are going, I'm sure Brighton, when you started Brighton then to Brighton now, the call volume has probably doubled. Your population has probably tripled. So it's
Yeah.
one of those necessary evils that unfortunately sometimes needs to happen.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, population now, I think we're serving about 65,000 folks. When we first started, I don't know if we were more than 15 or 20,000. I mean, it's Colorado's just been growing exponentially. And then when you talk about call volume, you're right. I mean, as a volunteer organization, the call volume was significantly less. Of course, then we recognize the need that we can't do all that with just volunteers, which is when that transition happens to career. And I don't remember exactly what we were running, maybe 1,000 or 1,500 calls a year to start with, somewhere in that ballpark. And then, you know, now we'll probably push past about 8,000 calls for service this year. But we've got a lot of future growth predicted. So just looking at what we'll probably see in the next 8 years, 8 to 10 years, is probably a population of about 100,000 folks that will serve. And of course, the call volume right behind that, the support, it probably somewhere around 12 to 15,000 calls, usually when you're about that kind of size. So.
Okay. All right. And I've had Chief Beeler and Marcos on here previously, but to say I remember certain stats about Brighton would be a huge lie because I talked to so many people. So to refresh the audience's memory, can you tell us the size of Brighton, amount of personnel, things of that nature?
Sure. Well, first things first, Marcos and Chief Beeler probably both lied about a lot of stuff, so I don't want to hold that against them. I mean, they're good people, but you know, they're storytellers, man. So be careful with those guys. No, I mean, great people, and they probably shared a little bit about Brighton. Currently, we're just about 90 line staff, so about 30 per shift, and then we've got our administrative side of things: fire prevention, finance, HR. I know I'm forgetting some stuff, but fleet and a couple other pieces of it rounds out about 124 folks. So that's about the size of our organization, 124 people, serving a community of about 65,000. We're a special district, so we serve more than just the city of Brighton. We serve Brighton, Henderson, Commerce City, parts of Lock Bowie, and Wattenberg, which are some of the surrounding smaller towns and cities around us. And then unincorporated Weld and Adams County. So we've got about 140 square miles of district that we cover. We do that with five fire stations and roughly an organization size. You want to round it up to about 125 people. And we're just over the last bunch of years been, you know, significantly responding to that growth with expansion and adding more people to the organization. So but I think that kind of gives us a pretty good summary. But we're an agricultural community. This fire department's been here since 1888. The city itself's been here since 1887. So we've got 135 years of kind of hard work and grit to make this community. And I think we try and, you know, embody that in our fire service personnel as well. We like, you know, just down to earth, hardworking people with great values. And that's what we've got as part of our organization to support the community that's kind of fundamentally built the same way. So
Okay.
embrace that heritage.
And as far as your apparatus.
Okay. Apparatus we've been working on over the last bunch of years. So we have four frontline engines, one aerial, one reserve aerial. Most of that's all Pierce equipment that we've been buying over the last few years. We added a rescue that was partially funded through oil and gas grant that we received, as well as a match from the fire district. We've got three medic units in service. Those are we purchased those through Arrow. It's a company in Iowa, if I remember right. And then we have kind of a few different styles of brush truck. We have four brush trucks in the district and four tenders in the district, water tenders to deliver water. So we're still kind of a rural setting with a lot of city mixed in, really transitioning to a lot of hydrogen areas. So we're looking about what does that future look like as we reduce the amount of brush trucks and tenders in our area and increase the amount of fire engines and medics that we need to respond to the calls in the community. So we've got a pretty good mix of that and a bunch of smaller fleet type stuff as well. So I think that's probably about what you're asking on the
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you're good. And you mentioned ambulances. Brighton does transport.
Correct. We didn't up until I think we started that in 2022. So going a couple of years now, we've got three medic units in service. One safety and medical officer, which is kind of an EMS supervisor. We call that the SAM or the safety and medical officer. That person helps oversee some of that program underneath the direction of the EMS chief. And then we have 7 field training officers, 2 per shift, give or take. And we've got one additional. Our kind of goal was 6. We have 7, which is great because we have a lot of folks to train. So that's kind of the build out of the EMS program. Before that, we partnered with our local hospital, Pie Valley Hospital at the time. Now it's Intermountain Health. And they provided the transport portion of that part of our responsibility as a fire district. So in our state, we're statutorily obligated to make sure that is either done by the fire district or supported through third party through the fire district. And we have been working on ALS engines for about 10 years before that, and getting to the point where we would at some point probably have to, just by based on need, do our own transport. What we found was that bringing transport in-house really increased the cohesiveness inside the fire station because we all cohabitated together. It helped with the call response and delivering really good, effective emergency services to our community as it relates to that medical need. And we're still partnered with the hospital to work on things that are outside of the 911 response scope to reduce some of that call volume that isn't maybe a 911 call, but is certainly someone's emergency. So that could be something as simple as someone needs a Band-Aid or whatever the case might be, because something. But they're helping with the interfacility transport and working towards what I would almost say is kind of more of that community paramedicine. And we're really blessed to have them in our community and working towards doing that so that we can focus on the 911 side of things, which I think is really what our people are, they're here for. That's what they want to do. So.
Right. So I do have a question, and only answer it if you feel comfortable. You said the medic units was started about 2 years ago. When you mentioned that to the department, was that an easy transition, or how was the vibe with the department? Did they want to do it? Did some not? Did some want to?
Yeah, great question. It was driven faster than I would have done it because our folks wanted to do that.
Okay.
They really wanted to make sure that they could understand the full kind of cycle of what it was to take care of a patient and then continue to immerse themselves and have that passion on the medical side. And we've got people that have got a high level of passion for the fire side and the medicine, and it's an amazing combination. And I think that's because we put a pretty good plan in place to take care of them, to be able to get a good mix of both. We're not trying to just say, hey, you're on the medic forever. We're trying to get you on and off the medic and the fire engine and get you kind of mixed into the community in different places so you can experience the different districts that we've got, the different apparatus, the different call types, and give people a kind of a well-rounded experience and enjoyment of their work through that. So that they were the hard drivers on it. It really wasn't me saying, hey, we got to go do this. They were looking for that opportunity to deliver a higher level of service. That's the kind of people that we have inside the organization. They recognize the work they do in the community, and they want to go out and do that at a very high level. And for them, they felt that they couldn't do it without having the ability to do the transport piece as well. And so we did that and put the support in all around them, and then said, go to work. And they went and did it, and they did great. So it's a lot of fun in the community because I get to go meet a lot of folks in our community. And I like a lot of people that come up to me and share stories about the care and the compassion that our people have delivered in those families' emergencies. And just hearing that is just a constant reminder of how good of work they're doing out in the field. And I didn't have that particular experience because I didn't have a medic when I was coming up, but I remember getting into the back of the Platte Valley medic units and working with them and always being awed by their level of care for our community, with their higher level of education, training, and expertise. And it's just great to see our folks being able to do that as well. So yeah, you got some hard drivers, so they drove it.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm sure that makes your job a lot easier. Awesome. Okay. And as far as minimum staffing across your apparatus or and your stations.
Yeah, so every fire apparatus is minimum staff 3. The medic units are 2. We have a staffing model where we can ride 4 at times, but just based on the kind of makeup of our organization, we've got some folks having babies, so we're missing people. And at least if you looked at it on paper, there's a person for each seat on each fire truck, so we could get 4 on each rig, and 2 on each medic. But we don't always make it there with vacations and sick and some of the other things that people have going on with their leave type stuff. So, Ideally, we're trying to get to be a slightly overstaffed model. This way, we're not behind because the hiring and training and education process just takes so long. Being down people for a year or two is just not helpful for our folks because it puts the load right back on them. And we know that for a long-term career, we want to make sure that they're getting the proper work rest cycles. So getting a little bit towards an overstaff, it impacts the budget, but it really makes a big difference for our people. And that's kind of the key of why we're trying to do it that way. And then keeping it in balance. I mean, I remember being a firefighter and just begging for one overtime shift for whatever, to help with the vacation or register a vehicle or pick a thing like that. Back then, we just didn't have a whole lot of overtime opportunity. And now we're just trying to find a balance of saying, yeah, maybe we can get you a shift or two. That's a good balance, helps out with the family budgeting, and then at the same time doesn't overwork you for the entirety of your career. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is kind of a two-part question. First part of the question, was the goal always to be fire chief? And the second part of that question is, can you describe your steps climbing through the ranks to get to that position?
Sure. I don't know if the goal is always to be fire chief. My family instilled a very high work ethic in my brother and I as we grew up, and in a high quality work ethic. So not just work, but quality work. And you don't know what all that means as a young person, and then you're trying to find your way in the world. And I was really enjoying my time in corporate America. I led a team there after a certain amount of time. And I think for me personally, serving in a leadership role really fits my personality trait. And recognizing that when people are in my charge, that it's my responsibility to care for them, similar to my family, how they cared for my brother and I as we were raised. And we grew up in a small community and everybody helped care for each other. And I don't know if that transfers to leadership or not, but one of the things I always just found a passion in was trying to learn how to better serve, become a better person. And so that way I could turn that around and share that with other people in a way that they could also increase their capacity for whatever passions they may have had. So that kind of resonates with who I am as a person. Whether that translates into fire chief or captain on a rig or firefighter, I feel like I've always kind of conducted myself very much the same way, with one caveat, that being as a 30-year-old versus a 50-year-old, there's certainly a difference in some maturity along the way and a little bit of wisdom gained. So I'm certainly less of a dummy than I was before, but I still like to have fun and enjoy and all those kinds of things. And I try not to take any of this stuff too seriously. It's serious work, but let's find a way through it all in a way that really engages everybody. So that's kind of, so that, I don't know, that was the first part of the question. So fire chief, not always, certainly towards the last part of my career. When I came offline, one of the things I think we recognize in the fire service is there's a lot of leadership styles out there, and not a lot of people recognize the need to improve in leadership, and they don't recognize that some of their own personality traits are holding them and their organization back. So you can really be ineffective as a leader, but think you're doing a great job. That's a lot. There's a lot of that out there. And I think we've all experienced that at some point in our career, whether in the fire service or not, and recognized, I don't want to do that, or I don't want to ever be that. And I think we learn a lot of lessons from that if you're paying attention. So I think for me personally, I was always kind of keyed into how do people care for people? So I don't know if leadership or being a leader, what exactly that means, but I think it means you really got to love and care for people. And if you do that, and you can do that in a way that also makes sure that the business side of things are cared for as well, then I think you got a great combination. That tends to be my style. I don't know if that, so that answer that I might have just answered.
No, you're good.
Okay.
I mean, because we can all relate to, and it doesn't even have to be just the fire chief. We can relate to lieutenants, captains, drivers, people that we've met or work with in the fire service. You tend to see people's good sides, bad traits, good traits, and it's just like you learn from both, especially from the bad. Like you definitely learn, like, I never want to be like this individual.
Correct. Yeah. And then there's some you're like, gosh, I wish I could do what that person does. Right. So there's both sides of that coin. If you're paying attention to, I'm a very positive focused type person. I look for those opportunities to emulate those leaders that I respected and learn how they did what they did. I think there's some of that that might be innate, but I also believe there's a significant portion that is learned. And a lot of it is learned through self-reflection, looking at yourself critically and being able to assess your strengths and weaknesses and then identifying a pathway forward through them, which may be finding a mentor that can help you with something, reading a book that might give you a kind of a pathway or methodology to help understand that better. In college, I loved psychology, sociology stuff, like the study of yourself and the study of groups. That to me, just even when I was taking classes there, like, well, I could get a degree in this. I don't know what I would do with it, but I found it very interesting. And truthfully, as a fire chief, or even as a, like you said, as a line officer, or pick a position, understanding who you are and the group you work in and understanding how to continue to find ways to improve that, that is leadership, regardless of what your title or rank may be. To me, I never looked at myself as rank as leadership. I just looked at myself as, could I help serve others? As a firefighter, could I help serve my officer with what they needed? As an officer, could I help serve my crew with what they needed? So to me, it was always leading doesn't always look like you have to have a rank or in our world, the bugles to go with that. It's how you can conduct yourself in the group of people and how you look at yourself critically to find ways to improve the trash you bring with you, so to speak, right? Because let's just say, you know, if we're getting paid a dollar, we're all worth about 80 cents, give or take. Sometimes it's 85 and sometimes it's 75. And I'm doing everything I can to make it 86 cents or 90. So when I'm receiving that compensation, I'm giving back as much as I can give back, with me working on the traits inside me that are not helpful in that regard. And even for me personally, when I first came in as the fire chief, I said, look, as the fire chief working with the board, I asked if I could rewrite my evaluation to something I thought would be better fit for me. And what I felt was, as a fire chief, you are either ineffective in your leadership style or effective in your leadership style. And the problem is, if you're ineffective, a lot of people suffer. So I don't need you're doing halfway good. I either need to know I'm either doing the work you need me to do or I'm not doing it. If I'm not, I need to put a strategy in place to get there so I can get that work done. Because if I don't do it, it really hurts 124 other folks. And that's a problem for me. And if I can't get it right for them, how can I expect them to get it right for the folks out in the community that they're supposed to be taking care of? So that's kind of a long-winded tangent on some leadership
nope.
stuff. I think really it's all about self-reflection and development and learning how to serve, deprioritizing your needs and vicariously receiving success through other people's success. And I think when we're younger, we love getting trophies. And at one point in my life, I was like, I'm never trophy, don't need a token or anything ever again. I'm good. All I want to be able to do is leave something behind to help make it better for others. And if it took me personally 5 years to figure out how to get there and get it done, maybe I can help someone else do it in 2.5 years and half the time. And then they can turn around and do it for that next person after them in half that time. And then together we all move forward so much faster by being able to kind of help pass on those lessons learned and those processes to get to become a better version of kind of who you want to be. So.
Understood. Okay. Well said. Well said. So with you now, you know, having been the fire chief for several years now, what was your vision towards how you wanted to see Brighton, and has that vision come to fruition?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think as the fire chief, you're always working on pieces of that. And I look at that vision as that, what's the picture on the wall look like of the ideal fire department, right? And we try and summarize that in a few different words. And I think one of the things I really gave a lot of contemplative thought to before I got here was what did I want to do as a fire chief at the fire department? And then what did I want to do as an impact in the fire service? And I'd love to be able to kind of get past even just the American fire service, but I don't know the world well enough to say I could help in the global fire service. So right now my scope gets me to the US, right? Like, how do we help this fire service in general? And so I thought about that. I did a lot of writing, of writing down things that I thought were important or lessons that I had learned along the way. And I did that with three specific mentors along the way to kind of help me fine tune some of these things. That was the current fire chief that I was working with, a neighboring fire district fire chief, and then my previous fire chief. And I asked them about all the lessons that they had learned and pitfalls and challenges and said, you know, there's so much knowledge in the fire service. Sometimes we just don't pass it all on to each other, right? And one of the things I've recognized is I've seen leaders leave and then take things with them. And we've got to find a way to leave some of this behind and some written word for people so that they can say, okay, even if I don't know what to do, I can pick this up and look at a little bit of a strategy here and say, oh, I can figure that out and take some of what they've learned, transfer it to that new skill set. I will tell you, for the first 30 minutes sitting in my office as the fire chief, I was like, oh my gosh, you are the fire chief. What are you going to go do? And I remember that being kind of scary for about 30 minutes. And then I realized you put a plan together before you got here. You shared it with the board. You shared it with 30 other firefighters that are part of this organization. And everybody brought you here because of that plan that you had lined out. So I brought a book with me to the interview process and all that stuff I've been working on for the years before that. And said, this is the fire department that I envision. Does anybody want to be part of that? And if you do, I can't do this by myself. I need a lot of folks that are behind that vision that could take pieces of this and help make us successful. So that's the strategy that I went in there with. And I've got nothing but a lot of respect for a lot of people that taught me along the way. Even in my AT&T corporate time, I had a really, really good regional manager that was a mentor that I would work with on kind of a big brother almost on how to do better and how to look for classes to improve skills wise, but also from a developmental standpoint. And so I kind of came in with all that stuff of, 25 years worth of learning how to try and figure this out. And really engaging in it with people to say, can you help me figure this plan? Where were you successful? Why would that work or not work over here? What are the pitfalls in not doing this particular piece? And there's a great document for from the fire chiefs, the first 100 days as a fire chief. Oddly enough, I did this kind of opposite. I didn't read it until after 100 days. I did that on purpose because I wanted to see what did you miss? And now what do you got to go do that you didn't recognize you had to go do before? And there's a few things and I'm like, oh, I could have definitely done that. And I did it that way because I wanted to kind of measure the things that I'd learned along the way against what kind of people said was a standard kind of document of how to be a fire chief over the first 100 days. And I did okay. So that was good. I apologize for a couple of things I missed. You know what I mean? I could have done better, but we can all do better.
And that's the thing. We're all human, you know, and even you being the fire chief, I think sometimes firemen sometimes tend or firefighters tend to forget that the fire chief puts their pants on one leg at a time, just like firefighters. So the fire chief can also make mistakes. Like it's going to happen. And I think sometimes we tend to not realize that whenever it's something like, well, why isn't he or she doing this or this, that, and the other? Like we forget you are human too. You have a life and you know, outside the four walls of the firehouse.
Sure. Yeah, I always used to joke with people on the rule of averages. I said, no one really escapes the rule of averages, meaning half of what you're going to do is going to be okay, and the other half's not going to be so good. And the hard part is figuring it out, making an apology, and moving forward, and giving each other a little bit of grace in our errors. And I'm with you. I joke with people. My role is no more important than our first brand new firefighter. Meaning we are all part of this team, and if one of us doesn't do our role and responsibility well, somebody or some group will suffer from that. And in the field, that could be someone's life. In my world, it can be, and I just, okay, I got to redo an SOG, big deal. You know what I mean? So I don't really place this, like the fire chief is the know-it-all of all things. It's just a role inside the organization. And really my role is that vision officer to constantly be painting that picture of where we're trying to get to. My head's up a lot. As we remember in the field, our heads are down working on whatever we're working on. We kind of learn a little bit of that heads up piece when you become an officer and keep your head up. And as a fire chief, it's just a little further up to be able to kind of see further down the road and kind of keep clearing that path for people so that as they're getting there, that pathway, while it might not be perfectly flat, is still way easier to traverse than if it was nothing but, the forest. So I look at it that way. And that might be different. I think a lot of people put a lot of self-importance into this particular role. But I don't see it that way. I see all of us working on one collaborative team, all with responsibilities that are all equally as important. And if we don't perform in those roles or responsibilities, we need each other to hold each other accountable to how to get us there. And that doesn't mean that we have to be mean or rude about it. We can certainly give each other grace, recognizing, like you said, we are all just human. We are all flawed and we will all make mistakes. our goal to each other is, can we just be graceful in our errors? Because none of us are perfect. I had someone doing that the other day, pointing fingers. I'm like, just so you know, when you do that, I mean,
You got
you point out someone else's error, and truthfully, that hurts those people. But you could find a way to partner and share your perspective in a way that becomes constructive to accomplishing the end result, unless you really just like tearing people down. And if that's the case, that's a different conversation, because we don't believe in that in our value set in this organization, which we have all agreed to. And we can have a conversation when we get out of line with values, that will happen. But when you conduct yourself completely outside of that construct, that becomes a problem, and it becomes my responsibility to hold those folks accountable. So,
Okay. All right.
least fun part of the job.
Oh, I bet. I bet so. With what you said, my next question to you is, what are Chief Garrison's standards and non-negotiables?
This is probably the biggest challenge, is I do believe in high quality work. It's something I know that if we do that right, it makes a difference for people. So I would even say more than believe, I know it is an important aspect of everything that we do. And high quality work can be all kinds of things. It could be something as simple as, how do we pick our color scheme for our fire truck, or how do we outline the equipment on the rig, or how do we make sure that from a communication standpoint, we're communicating well? So I believe in that quality has to be high quality. And then figuring out a construct to kind of measure some of that kind of stuff so that we know that we're making that mark. So for me, that's that. Non-negotiables are tough. I can find myself at pretty much anybody's plateau. So I'm happy to meet anybody where they might be and help bring them along with the organization. So I understand not everybody's going to have a high quality of work, or every day you've got to, do your PT, or or you should be eating healthy, and you should be in the books and educating yourself. I mean, I think those things are all very important, but they're important to me. And what's important to me might not be important to everybody else. But what I do believe in is, from an organizational standpoint, we all have to agree that our mission, the thing that we said to be true about our organization, what we're doing every day, is followed. When we don't do that, that's okay. I just need to put your hand up and say, I missed the mark. My apologies. I'll work harder on it next time. So I look at opportunities or mistakes as an educational cost. And as long as you're learning and educating and growing, then we are good. Where I struggle is that inability to recognize a need for change and then have that shared with you from various points of view, and you're not recognizing that need in yourself, because I can't do it for you. I can only help you as a teammate, but I cannot do the work for you. So I think that's kind of maybe one of those things that I would say is kind of a non-negotiable. From a vision standpoint, our organization, our vision truly is about supporting each other. So when I see that not happening, it upsets me personally, because generally when someone's not doing that, it hurts somebody else inside the organization. And that can be unintentional at times or intentional. And we've had a little bit of both, where we've recognized with folks that doesn't meet our standard. So we're going to change things for just a little bit. And that could mean that you're not going to perform in a role that you've been performing in before, until we can get this part remediated, corrected, and then work from that platform. I kind of remember it this way. When you're in the maze, right? And you're going through that maze the first time, packed up with your bottle on, and you got ropes and wires all over, and you hit one of those things, and you just try and push harder, right? And you ain't going anywhere. I mean, it's fun to watch. You're just going to keep getting hung up. You can push as hard as you want, but you got to back up. You got to clear that problem that you got hung up on, and then get yourself in the right position, and then move forward. And I look at that same lesson that we learned on the drill ground day one, and I apply that in leadership as well. Basically saying, when we have a behavioral challenge or any of those things, it's no different than the time you got hung up in the maze. Let's do the same things. Let's back up. Let's clear the hazard. Let's reposition, and then let's move forward. Now, while that might take 5 minutes to do in the maze or less, in our world, that might take 5 months to do to get that. So they're a little bit different kind of curve there. But so that's kind of the vision aspect of things, and kind of an expectation there. And then on values, we put five values that we believe to be true in our hearts, and said, this is the stuff when we make decisions and when we're doing things, these are the things we will not compromise on. So we will not compromise on compassion in our community. We will not compromise on community. We will not compromise on being in an organization of integrity and building pride in our organization. Like all those things, when we make our decisions, does that meet those values? And if it does, then we're good to move forward. And if it doesn't, then we don't do that. And if it's something where it's a behavioral issue, we'll work to correct it. And if we can't get it corrected, then that changes the conversation. Generally, we've been really good, and I have a conversation with all of our new folks in the beginning where academy is a time to learn, and your probationary year is a true time to make sure that you fit into this fire family. From a values perspective, you might fit in the fire service, but you might just not fit in this family for whatever reason, incongruence in value sets, yours versus the organization's. And so that's one of the things I share with them in the beginning is we will figure out within your first year if that's a fit for both sides. And if it is, you're part of the family. And after that, we'll work through with your challenges as you have them, and we'll help you. You just got to be willing to accept the help. And sometimes in the firefighter world, that's hard. But if I think we approach those conversations with some compassion for our people, a little bit of empathy, I think we found a way through most of those issues. So.
Okay. All right. What does the term aggressive mean to you?
Sure. It's funny. I almost want to look up the definition of aggressive because I've done this before with folks, and we're an aggressive fire department. We kind of don't say that in our organization anymore. Not because we believe it to be bad. It's just that we don't believe that to be true about us. What we do believe to be true is that we are a professional organization that's highly trained and prepared for the emergencies that we come into contact with. And because of that preparation, we don't have to be aggressive. We're well prepared. And a well-prepared organization to respond to these emergencies is what we're trying to do. I think when we were talking about sports and those kind of things, being aggressive is good because you're in competition with another team, but we're not in competition with another team. We're here to help make a difference in every emergency that we go to. And if you sometimes you want to put that in the terms of win loss, kind of similar to sports, but it really doesn't work that way in our world. So when we say aggressive, I think that it's a fun buzzword in the fire service community. I don't know if it really describes us as a community of firefighters. I know what describes our particular fire department, which is a highly trained and well-prepared organization to go out and serve on any emergency. And that's a lot of chief speak, basically for saying we want to go do a good job, right? And that's it. So how do we get there? Because sometimes aggressive could mean you lack the competency to go do the thing you're going to go do, but because you're aggressive, you're going to go do it anyway. And incompetence and aggressiveness do not serve anybody well. So let's build competence, and then let's build a good di mental discipline and discipline in the field to go do the things we know we can go do well, and ask for help on the other things that we might not be able to do well. Now that might be from a community partner or a neighboring fire district or whatever the case might be. So for all of you folks on the aggressive thing, look up what aggressive means and see if it really fits who you are, or is that just kind of a cool word in the fire service right now? Because I'm sure at one point, I don't know, pick a time. You didn't have to say you were aggressive because people just saw the work quality you did. And they're like, that is a highly professional firefighter. You don't have to put your name aggressive on it because they can see that you're doing good work. I think we kind of put that tag on there to say, I want you to know I'm good. I'm going to use this word to say I'm good. And whether it means I'm good or not, I don't know. So, yeah. I think, and Dan, provide a different perspective if you, because I know you talk to a lot of people. For me, I've never described myself as an aggressive fire, but I always describe myself as a properly trained, physically fit, and mentally prepared person to go out and serve in the community. And I don't know if that makes me aggressive or not, but I feel like the work quality we did as crews was good, as a shift was good, as an organization was good, and we didn't have to put a label on it like that. So I don't know.
No, you're good. I love hearing it. Love hearing it. Realistic training on a small budget. So I will always like to say I don't know what Brighton's budget is on training, but what kind of training or realistic training do you bring for your members?
Sure. We're always kind of in kind of competition with the dollars of how to support training. So first things first, one is when it comes to training, I believe that the best training you're going to do is in-house with your crew. Because it doesn't matter what hose load you pick, it doesn't matter this or that. If you don't practice and train with those basics every day, it doesn't matter how good you are at this other thing that you may or may not ever use. You got to have the basics down. So when you talk about training, you can do a lot of stuff in your fire station for no cost other than your investment in sweat equity, right? Put the work in, do it at the fire station, and those kind of things to me always went a long way. Because if you had a crew that wanted, and it doesn't mean you have to train all day either. You can do a couple quick hits. Then we're gonna hit a morning training for 45 minutes, an afternoon training for 45 minutes, PT somewhere in between there, and calls all along the way, right? Like you can do that. That's to me, that's the best budget training you can do. And then taking a perspective of you can't get it all at your own fire district or your fire department. You gotta go outside and get perspective to your training too, because just because you think doing it that way is good doesn't mean it is good. It just means you think it's good. So you've got to get people to add some filler to that for you to say, hey, that is or that isn't, or you could do a little bit different this way and really get some good effective training out of that by adding this other piece. So you need partnerships in the fire service to give you perspective in training. So there is a little bit of an investment in that, but you can do that either through, let's say, conferences or some regional trainings, or you know what you can do? This one's really cheap. There's right next to you, there's a fire department, and they're different than you. You ever call one of those crews and say, hey, can I come train with you for a day? Can we get together and do a training? Can I meet you on an off day for 45 minutes? That's what I used to do. Look, we're a small fire district north of Denver. So when I was learning as a company officer coming up, I went down with the folks I knew at Denver Fire, Aurora Fire, which are the two kind of big ones just to the south of us. And just on my own time said, can I jump in on with you on your standpipe training? Because while we've got some standpipe stuff here, doing it totally different down there. So maybe I can learn a couple of lessons, bring them back to my crew. So if you as an officer or want to invest in your people and do some low budget training, you take an hour out of your day and go train with a neighboring department and bring it back. And by the way, you can tell everybody you thought of it yourself if you really wanted to, but you're just going down there and there's and people will share with you. Like that's easy stuff you can do right next door with people, and you build relationships with your neighbors. I don't know, man. Like to me, that's low cost training. From a past training chief who still loves training, I wanted to do something for our community that was a little bit different than we had done in the past, which is larger multi-jurisdictional trainings. I just want to get five fire departments, five different fire trucks on the same fire drill ground and run an evolution and say, can we do this together and support each other as neighbors and do some practice with that? So that was the stuff I loved doing. Now that had some expense in the overtime required to help support that training, but we did that a couple times a year where we do multi-jurisdictional trainings, and those multi-jurisdictional trainings would allow us all to kind of share some best practices. So while you got a little bit of an investment and some overtime to make sure you got enough training staff there, crews got together with other crews from other fire districts, which was I was doing on my own as a company officer, was able to do that in a larger scale as a training chief and create the mechanism for people to go do that. So I think that's big. And then yeah, I mean, as a training chief, you're going to give everybody the things they need over the course of a few years, but you just can't give it all to them. So I don't know. I don't know if that answers the budget issue with the
No, you're
training, but
good. You're
those are
good.
some training philosophies I think are important. But here's all that doesn't really mean a whole lot if you don't want to do it, right? So are you engaged as a firefighter? Are you that person like, oh, it's too hot out to train? You know what I mean? If you're saying, if that comes out of your mouth, I take issue with that, because what that's telling me is that you don't want to be a professional and you don't want to put the work in. You're either going to sweat right there, or it's that kind of that you bleed in the gym or bleed out in the field. You're going to pick your place, and it comes back to that kind of two disciplines: the discipline of the pain up front, or the discipline or the pain of regret, because now you're not prepared. And in our world, not prepared means maybe not coming home, or maybe someone on your crew's not coming home, or maybe someone's family member's not coming home. And that's in no particular order other than you have got to be ready for that toughest time and you got to put the work in. And if you're saying things like it's too hot out, or I didn't get my workout stuff in, and well, I don't pick a problem. I drank my workout drink, got to work out now, cat LT, I can't train right now. And we got to have officers that are helping lead that charge
That's
all
true.
the time.
That's
And
true.
on the other side of that is, as a trainer, don't be a jerk. Be supportive. Training is nurture, nurture, nurture. Like you are helping people learn skills and techniques that they don't know how to do. And while we can have fun making fun of some of the things that happen, certainly for sure, but be a nurturing trainer to help people learn the skill set in a way that doesn't make them feel like they're an inadequate person, which I think we see a lot of, right?
Yes, sir.
And no wonder why they don't want to train anymore. You've been beating the heck out of them with, emotionally, they don't want to go back for more of that. We got enough challenges out in the field doing the work that we all do, right? We don't need to make it harder on each other in the firehouse. We just need to help sharpen each other. And we need to do that in a way that doesn't push people away and recognizes not everybody's you. And we all got to do this thing together. So how do we all get there together? So low budget training, real easy. Be nice, nurture, go learn a little bit, share what you learned, and then find some mechanisms to bring other people into it. So if you found something good on your shift, why are you not saying, hey, training chief, whatever you got in your organization, can I get a little bit of time to teach this skill on the other shifts? And let me go out and if you don't have the money, I'm okay with doing it on my own time. Like, are you willing to put that level in? Like, that's how
Right.
I.
That's right. That's right.
Because if you're helping
Yes.
that whole org, by the way, they're going to give that back to you someday. That is an investment that one day will pay dividends back to you personally. And it might be at the time where you need that particular skill to save yourself or others.
No,
Always look.
definitely.
You never know when it's coming, but it's coming, right?
Definitely. Definitely. I think we have gotten, some of us have gotten to a point where if we want something, we expect the department to pay for. Or like, if you want to better yourself, there are going to be times where if the department can, let's just say they went over budget, they're like, hey, we just can't. Like, you need to come to terms with, well, if you really want to benefit yourself and your department, then you might just have to eat the cost and just do it on your own time. But it seems like if it's like, am I getting overtime? No, well, I'm not doing it. It's like, I get it. Times are tough. Inflation's crazy. But at some point, if you want, but that's the way I look at it. Like when it comes to me going to outside training, my training chief has developed a program now where he's not going to pay you to go unless it's like required, mandatory. But like if it's outside training for me, he'll go, okay, you're gonna pay your airfare, your hotel costs, whatever, your travel. What I will do for you, I'll give you time for time. And
Oh,
I'm good
that's
with
wonderful.
that. And it's like he is investing in me and I'm investing back to the department. So I wish more people would see that besides the bigger picture of, am I getting paid? Nope. All right, I don't want to do it.
One of the things you can do, and I believe in kind of setting up little opportunities for yourself, right? So right now, if you wanted to break down some terms, you could say, well, we have non-exempt and exempt employees, right? So non-exempt, you're going to make overtime. Exempt, you're not getting overtime. Treat yourself as an exempt employee in your whole life. Try that.
Yes.
If you're and easy numbers, if you're making 100,000 in whatever role you're in, you're making the money to pay everything you need in your life. Like, you've got your stuff covered. More money always helps. So I always took the position of, pay me, don't pay me, I don't care. I look at this as I'm a salaried employee. I looked at it this way from my background. And when I went and trained and I had to increase my level of education and expertise and all that kind of stuff, it was an investment in myself. If I was willing to invest in myself, I could turn around and invest that back in other people. And all those things yield over time. If you want the immediate return of an 8-hour paycheck, fine. I wasn't worried about that. I was looking at compounding interest. Invest in yourself, invest in others, and it all comes back. If anything else, that's how I wound up being the fire chief. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know if that's how I did it or not, but I think about those kind of things is you set the construct for how you think about things. And you can let other people set it for you if you want. Well, I should be getting more money. Sure, why not? Or if you can't get department support, because times are tight, and I'm with you. I saw a thing yesterday that in Colorado, you need to be making at least 15,000 more than you did in 2021 to be at the exact same place you were in 2021. And I don't know if people have been able to make those kind of increases over the last couple of years, because that's a lot of increase for some people. So I think about that, and I think about, like, there are challenges out there. There's certainly challenges, and things are more expensive, and this is a very weird time economically, that even as a fire chief, how do we give people our proper compensation so they can afford
Right.
just the basics, and I worry about our youngest people in the organization at the lowest salaries, thinking, how are they able to buy enough food for their family? Like, I worry about that kind of stuff. And it used to be, it didn't have to be like that. We could do our standard COLA raises. We were all okay. You know what I mean? Everybody had what they needed, a little bit of what they wanted. Life was good. You know what I mean? But I do worry about our young people now in this economy. It is a challenge to figure out how to navigate that. That's a whole nother thing. But back to what we're talking about is you want to do low budget, invest in yourself, and then recognize in investing you get this thing called compounded interest, which is you put the work in up front, and down the road someday you will receive dividends back.
Definitely.
And or be a short-term thinker. I just want my 8-hour paycheck and I'm out of here, and otherwise I'm not doing it. But this job, the work we do, it's too dangerous to have that kind of mindset. You
Yep.
know what I mean?
You're right. You're
And
right.
if you remember, the fire service started as an altruistic opportunity to help other people. So you getting training and education goes to do what? Help other people. Like that's how we started. The fire service started with helping people. And I don't know, but I love the fact that I started as a volunteer. It wasn't my intention to do so. And I will still joke with people. I used to do it for free. And if I could figure out a way to still help make sure my family was taken care of, I'd still be doing it for free. You know what I mean? And when you're a younger person, you can give that time, and that's great. As we work through our lives, you know, not all of us are financially independent. So I understand you've got to receive compensation, but if you're good with the salary you've received, you can make those things work, and you can do it on your own time. Now, that's weird in today's age because most people don't believe that. You know, that
Yes.
sounds like at your department, Danny, they're taking great care of you, just trying to find a way to help you. And that's
Exactly.
what we're looking for, right? Just can we find common ground? You know, I can't do this, I can't do that, but I can get you time back. And you're like, I can do that, right?
Yeah.
That's that perspective of saying, how can I help you and what you need? And how can I help all of us with what we need? And we come together saying, okay, I get it. I'm not making overtime, but I got a little time back. So I can still get a little time back with my family. I'm still learning, I'm still giving back. That is win-win. We need to find more win-win everywhere. So
Definitely. And I 100% agree with you. And what I'm going to say next might not be popular with certain listeners, but I have to say it. Another thing I think that would help us, we all know we don't come into this profession for the money. Well, at least most of us should know that. But what would help is live within your means. You know, we have. I was guilty. When I got hired, man, the first thing when I knew I was getting a paycheck every 2 weeks, what I did, Mom, I'm going to get a truck. I need a co-signer. I did it, but live within your means, especially nowadays. Trucks are like six figures, and I'm like, I'm not paying that.
No, I'm with you on that. And look, I'm a car guy. I love cars and some of that kind of stuff. So I get it, you know, and I like a nice truck too, or a nice car. And I think you bring up just a really good point is, and I think really that's a symptom of a problem, right? What the problem is we're not helping teach our people financial security. Like, we don't think it's our job, but it is our role. As an organization, as teammates, as crews, we should be helping each other with some of our financial choices. And I know that's getting kind of in people's business a little bit, but if we really care about people,
Yes.
then that's what we do. We help each other out with that. And when you care, you share a perspective that other people might not have. And I don't know what people are being taught right now. And I know people say, oh, you got taught how to balance a checkbook. Well, guess what? No one's using checkbooks anymore, so that doesn't really matter. But we just got to teach people how to live within their means. We need to do that organizationally. It should be part of our initial onboarding of our new folks, and then followed up through the course of the year with some additional support, whether that's a financial planner coming in. And I know that's hard because some people want their own financial planner, some people don't. I'm just trying to talk about the people that are just getting started. Let's get them on
Yes.
the right track, right?
Right.
And I'm with you. We try and share right up front, like, don't buy a brand new truck day one. You know, give yourself a year. You get a year into the job and you're making a little bit more money, you live on last year's wages, and you find a way to invest the other part you get out of your new paycheck or your new raise. And that helps set you up for your future, so you can actually retire someday with your mind and body still intact. And we can have a whole discussion about retirement, but we got to teach our young people how to financially prepare, how to invest properly, and how not to spend every dime, and how to avoid some pitfalls. We know we're all pitfalls. Like, it might not be something wrong with buying the new truck, But then buying the $5,000 set of rims and tires are going up. Maybe that's the bad part of the purchase. You know what I mean? Because that's
Yeah.
nothing but depreciation and totally lost money. But the truck, it's going to serve you. It's going to get you to work every day. You're going to lose money on it over time, but it's going to take care of you and do the. It'll be a useful tool. Now, do you need the $100,000 truck? Or I think these days you might be able to get away with maybe a $60,000 truck. I don't know what the pricing is right now, but just a little bit of conservancy in the purchase might be helpful in the beginning, right? And as you go over time, you can, like, I finally bought maybe a year ago, just something I like, okay, saved up money, worked hard, I bought a little bit of a fancier car that I probably needed. That's okay. But I also joke with people, I haven't had a car payment in a bunch of years. What do you think I've been doing with the money? I think I've been taking it to Vegas and wasting it on the blackjack table. I've put it in a bank. So.
No, I love it. I love it. And I also love the fact that you hit, I was going to ask you, but you already hit it and we don't need to go down it, but you are a firm believer in outside trading, which is awesome. You know, getting outside of your four walls of the way your organization does things.
Yeah, we've got a lot of great community out there. And here's, I'll tell you one thing too. I think there are some things that are shared at certain communities outside of your own district that may not be, that might not align with your values. So when I share with everybody, I said, remember, not everything you hear will align with who we are as an organization. And just because you heard it at a conference doesn't make it gospel. It's just another perspective. And what I would ask you to do is when you bring things back, test it a little bit, test it on a couple folks, not the whole org. And to see what the feedback is. And if someone shares with you, hey man, that's really not us, whatever it might be, you know, pick a thing. So we've had that happen where people, we look, 90% has been amazing that comes back. You're going to get a couple things back. Like, yeah, that doesn't fit us. So let's not do that one. And that's okay. That's called discernment, right? We need to learn that skill of making a decision on what's good for our organization and our people and our community and what's not. And there are some things that I believe are more self-serving than community service. So.
Definitely. Okay. What's your take on leadership, whether company officer or chief officers? I always love hearing you know, different people's perspectives on what they think leadership should be.
Okay. So I'm going to just step to the side for a second, then come back to that. In our vision statement, we are trying to do everything we can to create servant leadership everywhere. I don't care what your rank is, what your responsibility is. We want you to be a type of leader that helps serve others. And so I'm a very big believer in that. And that's kind of starts in the beginning of time. You see that, like, people serving other people through some of the best leadership stories you'll read. I don't want to get too religious with anybody, but some of the best leadership stories you'll see are in the Bible. And if you read a lot of books after that, you'll say, like, that story comes back to this one a couple thousand years ago. So I think there's a lot to be said for that book and those stories. I think there's a lot to be said for a lot of the leadership stuff that's been shared since, which is generally some rehashing of those kind of principles. And when it comes to leadership in the firehouse, I want all of our folks to envision themselves as a leader and whatever purview they have, the ability to impact. And I want them to do that through some form of service. Now, when it comes to our officers, truthfully, the most important leaders in our fire district are our officer corps, right? Those lieutenants and captains, they're out every day working with people, and they can do that really, really well and impact people in a very positive way, or they can do it poorly and really make some people's lives miserable, right? And we've probably seen that stuff everywhere. So I think from a organizational perspective, our most impactful leaders are those lieutenants and captains on the fire truck in the firehouses that are really helping grow and mature our new people inside the org. From a leadership staff, so chief officers, and I call that kind of the leadership team really needs to come together and create consensus on how we're going to go do things going forward and then support, serve all of our people that are out in the field. So that's the perspective that we take, is that we are here to serve these folks so that they can go serve in the community. We know we're doing it well when we get great feedback from the community. We know symptomatically if we're not doing that well that we'll get negative feedback because people will become apathetic or won't put that care into taking care of other people. So from a leadership, and I would call that maybe your chief staff, or some people call it the executive team. I don't know. I understand that word, but I don't know if it really fits in the fire service, that phrase. So I really just look to say, how do we lead as leaders? And a lot of that really just comes down to we make a lot of things happen in admin. What happens in most organizations is it doesn't get translated to everybody out so in the field. So really, I don't know, being a good leader is being a good communicator, but I think they're really tied closely together. Because people want to know and want to be part of what's happening. So getting other people's buy-in in some of the decision-making process, right? So we'll have a little discussion that starts with how we get to a decision. That good discussion and involving different people's perspectives in that discussion gets us to a good decision. And then communicating that decision to everybody in a way that they can then interpret it and then start using it is also very important. Because if we just make a decision and don't explain the why behind what we're doing and how we got there and who gave the feedback, people won't understand. So as leaders, we've got to be really good communicators and find ways to do that. And we've done that through a few different methodologies, right? We send out a every chief, let me rephrase that. Once a week, a chief sends out an update on their area of purview because they're making choices and decisions in there. But if they don't tell anybody about those, no one knows what's going on. And if we're missing something, somebody won't be able to put their hand up and say, "Hey, chief, don't forget X." Like, "Oh yeah, appreciate that. We thank you." So we can avoid a pitfall, right? And it helps serve better. So we do that for a reason. We have a lot of discussion through messaging to say, "Here's kind of what's happening. If you see a hole in it, please poke so we know." And don't be mean about it. Just say, "Hey, by the way, I see a gap." So that really, because here's the other thing in our organization. We've got great people, brand new, and we want them to give their input. And I know that's weird in the fire service because it's like, "Hey, we all first got here is, kind of shut up and listen and blah, 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 blah." But people want to know why we're doing stuff. They don't want to just be told to do stuff. So you got to explain the why behind what we're doing. We've got to recognize that they bring a value and skill set that if we just don't let them make a contribution, that can isolate them and they want to contribute with whatever they're passionate about. And we've got to give them mechanisms to share those passions because they have a whole different perspective. It could be something as simple as, "Hey, chief, you don't even know how to make a PowerPoint. Let me show you how to do it the proper way, right?" And now my presentations are amazing because I've got some brand new person that knows how to use this new system that can that creates a better connection with the material I'm trying to share, right? And what's important is it my PowerPoint or the connection that's made? And it's the connection. And if I can have someone help me make that connection better, perfect. We'll use that. So communicate back just back a little bit. Communication's a really important one from the leadership side. And then face-to-face stuff. You got to get out and meet with your team. I do it in a few different ways. We did kind of a coffee or like a breakfast, which morphed into kind of a coffee. So once a month, we're always rotating through. We do the chiefs go out and just have coffee. And there's no agenda other than to listen. It's a listening tour. Hear what has to be said. How are we doing? Where are we missing? What struggles have the crew seen? What do we need to see catch on the radar that we might not see from an office? You know what I mean? And let's take that back. And tell everybody that we're really amazing and figured out on our own, which is not true. I'm just saying that's a joke. Crews told us, you know what I mean? And we fix it. That's our job. Tell us what you need. We'll fix it for you. So we do that. I try and meet with every crew through lunch. I think that's just, I love breaking bread with the crew and I want to hear what they've got to say. And I want them to get an opportunity to sit with their fire chief at least a couple times a year to share what's important to them. So we do that. And then I love PT. Everybody should be working out from the chief down. That's my personal opinion. You're better in any role if your physical strength is there because it helps you with your mental capacity. And a lot of what we do up here is no longer physical, it's mental. But if you really want to have the mental fortitude that you need, you got to be doing some exercise to build it, right? So I try and get out to the crews and not every day. I try and do a couple a week. And I try and rotate fire stations and get out with the crews and do some sort of exercise with them. I love it, one, because I love doing PT with them. I love when everybody gets tired, because once everybody's tired, they don't know this is like a secret. The truth comes out. You know what I mean? Like before PT, they're a little bit guarded. After PT, when everyone's breathing heavy and sweating on the floor, like, "Chief, why are we doing this?" I'm like, "Ah, someone's finally asking a question they really want to know the answer to." So I love that part. So keep that, edit that part out. Don't tell them I'm doing that. I get them tired and I get the truth. And then we get, that's where we make a lot of good change.
One thing I loved you said was, and to me, you there is a time and a place and a tone that you must do it. But if somebody must question you or ask you a question of why or can't we do this a little better, we have certain chiefs out there who will get angry, shut it down, and leave. And you're sending that's why most of the time firemen don't really want to tell you when you come around what's going on because the fear of retaliation or I'm going to hurt the chief's feelings. And like I said, time, place, and tone, three important things we must remember. We can't just have the chief come and bombard with problems and give no solutions.
Always find a way to win, right? I always tell the crews, like, there's stuff within your power and there's a way to win. So I'll give you an example. I went out to the station the other day. I'll give you a couple of examples. Went out to the station the other day. I see one of our SOGs sitting on the table, and I said, "Oh, cool, what you guys do?" Like, "Oh, we had the new person go through the SOG, do a little presentation." I'm like, "Great." I said, "This SOG is out of date." I said, "We don't even do that anymore." I'm like, "Yeah, we know." I'm like, "Okay, so did you let that lieutenant know that's in charge of SOGs?" I'm like, "Oh no, we didn't do that." I'm like, "Come on, guys. You find the problem, you are empowered to fix it. And guess who's impacted most directly by the SOG? All of you. Not me. I'm sitting in the office. I don't have an SOG on how to use my stapler, right? That's my big one." And that's a joke, just having a little bit of fun with that. But in reality, right, like, this impacts you. When you find a mistake, we put a team in place to fix it. So all you got to do is let someone know, hey, SOG, whatever, line, whatever needs to be fixed. We don't do that anymore. So the SOG should be what we do out in the field, right? Unless what we're doing out in the field doesn't meet standard, then we need to change what we're doing out in the field to meet the SOG. Or conversely, if we don't do that out in the field, but the standard is, then we update the SOG to meet what's out there. So either way, like, we're trying to take care of both sides on that. I did go to a fire station the other day. I was just stopping in to catch up with one person, and a discussion ensued. And like anything, I'm always willing to listen. But it was one of those things where it kind of caught me off guard, and at a time where I was had other business to attend to. So I kind of gave a short answer, but I followed back up with a text to one of the guys. I'm like, "Hey, great points. Love what you're saying. Let's continue the conversation. I just couldn't do it today." So we'll come back and follow up on that. But I also believe too, and you brought up a good point, is people use it for retaliation. Like, I won't take anything that you share with me and use it for bad. I will always use it for good. Now, I might not like what you have to say, or I might disagree, and we can have that discussion around that disagreement. And you might not like what I have to say, or you might recognize something that about your organization you didn't know. So I'll give you an example. We budget in operations, your general budget, and then we budget in capital, which is, your fire trucks and equipment, all that kind of stuff, your big stuff. And each one of those budgets is different. It's not like your home account where you can just move money from one account to the other. Like, it doesn't work that way, right? So we had more people in a schooling process than we'd expected, so our overtime got tight. But then I had a couple of people pointing at the fire truck that was getting remediated with some striping and some stuff. So, well, why are we spending money on that if we don't have an extra money for overtime right now? So I had to go out and, okay, education, right? Okay, obviously not everyone understands how this works. That money that's allocated in capital is allocated in capital, and I can't just take that money and move it over to pay for overtime. It just doesn't work that way. There's a board process for approval, there's a state process of review, and there's an auditing process after to make sure you did it the same you were going to go do that kind of stuff, right? And look, I don't expect our fire folks to know everything about budgeting, but I do need to understand, hey, don't get frustrated and point fingers at that thing, because that has nothing to do with your. So it's a symptom, right? Symptom is I need to help share and educate people better on how we budget. So I recognize it as a symptom. And every time I hear things that are challenging, is it really that challenge, or is it a symptom of something else? A lack of education, my inability to explain it properly, or my inability to recognize a need that should have been recognized, right? So it could be any of those things. But I go away with a blank mind. Like, tell me what you got. I'm going to use it for good. Not going to get mad about it. Every now and again, you might catch me at a time where I have to be a little short. I don't mean that to be the case. Just sometimes, just the course of business, I got to move a little quicker. I don't have time to go through a full explanation. But I will always follow up with those folks. But I think the big thing is we got to listen to our people. They're closest to most of the problems, right? Like, if you're a firefighter out in the field and you got a problem, you're seeing it. Guess what? I'm not seeing your problem. So I need you to share that with me, because my job is to help you overcome that challenge.
Love it. And I love the fact that you mentioned that, because, and you know, it's not a shot at any fire chief of any organization, but you're counting on your line officers, your boots on the ground, to tell you things that you do not see, because you don't run the frequent medical calls or the fire alarms or whatever the case may be. So you are counting on, and you are open and receptive to your line officers going, "Hey, chief, we've discovered an issue on X," whatever the case may be. Awesome. Thank you. And we'll get the ball rolling. You know, but it's been my experience that sometimes we have chiefs that kind of forget that, you know, like they forget what it's like being out in the field, in the streets. And so I think it's always awesome and important where, now, organizationally dependent, if you can, because there are some large organizations where the fire chief can't go to every station to see
Correct.
all the shifts. But if you are in an organization where you can do that, every once in a while, step out of that office and see what's going on.
And truthfully, we need all of us as fire chiefs need to be stepping out of the office more. But there are ways that our folks can help us with that, right? Do me a favor. Let's not the easy one, right? Let's not create a personnel issue that's going to take me 2 weeks to do all this other stuff on, right? Keep each other out of trouble. That frees up my time so I can do more for you,
right?
Right, that kind of thing. So the, I mean, and that's an extreme example. I think in reality, just as fire chiefs, we do spend too much time in our office. There's a challenge with that. There's a lot of things that require some attention. But like anything, if you learn how to manage your time and schedule and use your time effectively, you know, for example, the firefighters, right? I'm early to the call today. You know, we're always early to everything, right? But now as a fire chief, I'm there. If the meeting starts at 8, I'm there at 7:58 and I'm right in the meeting and then I'm out to the next one. And I've got people that help me say, hey, chief, don't forget, you got to get to the next thing. Because I've got to get all these touches. And it's hard in the fire service because we love conversation. Mm-hmm. And when you're at the firehouse, you're there for 24 or 48. So you're not going anywhere. And I kind of got to remember crews like, hey, I got to get home tonight. I know it's 6. I know I just got done with PT with you. But my goal is always to get home to about 6 o'clock to the family so that I can have dinner with them and have that time too. Right. But it's hard because like crews still there. Like they remember the time we used to have bumper time at 2 in the morning, you know, after a call, talk about whatever, you know.
Right.
I love that time too. But
right.
As a fire chief, you really got to learn how to manage your time and learn what's most important and remember that every day. Write it on your wall if you need to. Your people are the most important thing. Your emails will still be there. You know, the other challenges that we face with council or the board will still be there. They need to be addressed. But you've got to give time to your people so you can hear what they have to say. And truthfully, they've got probably the majority of the time the better solution than you could come up with in your office anyway.
Definitely.
So if you really want to look like a smart fire chief, just go listen to your crews. They'll tell you. And if you follow a lot of that, you're going to find yourself in a really good partnership with them because they'll trust you. They know you're not going to hurt anybody with what you're given, and you're doing things to help individuals or organization, the whole organization, with what they've shared. So
definitely, definitely. Okay. We're almost wrapping up here, but before I ask this last question, I know we kind of discussed before we started, I want you to briefly discuss that discussion and decision. Cause I've never heard of it. And so I like the way you presented that.
Okay. Yeah. So part of what we do in our organization is we've kind of defined two different things. One is we've defined what a discussion looks like, and then we've defined what a decision looks like. And it's weird. You don't think you have to do that, but you do. The reason for that is a lot of discussion happens before any decision, right? You, at home, you're trying to decide what to do. What do? You and your significant other, you're having discussion, right? And if other people are overhearing that, they could say, well, that sounds like they made a decision to do something, but in reality, you're still in discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So in discussion, you want multiple points of view that are not your own to make sure that what you're about to go do is the right thing. Because here's the hard part. When you're making a decision, whether you're wrong or right, it feels the exact same way. Okay, let that one sink in for a second. Whenever you're making a decision, whether you're wrong or right, it feels like you're right. Because if you knew you were making the wrong decision, you wouldn't do it.
Right.
Well, the hard part is you don't know what's the wrong or right decision until after the fact. Okay. That's the litmus test afterward is what happened afterward. Was it good? Right decision? Was it bad? Wrong decision. So you've got to recognize that you have a little bit of a false sense of security in decision making. So to do that properly, you have to have a lot of good discussion. And generally, if there's someone you don't want in the room for whatever reason, it's probably the person that should be there because they're going to give you an opinion you don't want to hear.
Sure. Yes, sir.
And the ground rules look like this. Try not to hurt me with your opinion. Right. So just tell me what you got. Let's just be nice about it and let's hear. So in discussion, we have a lot of good discussion that can involve a small team of, you know, 1, 2, or 3 people, or it can involve a group of 10. I don't, you know, figure out how you're going to have that discussion. And then in there, as the leader of that group, you've got to start kind of narrowing down what the decision might look like or the options might look like. If we go this route, we could do this, or if we do this, we could do a combination of these couple things. Okay, do we all agree and have kind of consensus that we agree this to be the best process forward, whatever that might be, this decision? And then you could say, okay, our decision is to do X. And then once you've made that decision, you need to communicate it. That should be communicated by the person that it most impacts in oversight. So if that's an EMS decision, the EMS chief should communicate it. If it's a training decision, the training chief should communicate it. If it's the finance division or the fire marshal's office, Those are the people we want to communicate those decisions. It does. It's not everyone kind of thinks like, oh, the chief's got to share it. No, that I want you to share from where most is impactful. But I really would like to clarify that in the beginning, because why that I came to those terms is, in part of my travels, we would have some discussion. People would overhear the discussion. It would go to another group, and that group would think a decision was made. And then, that group would become worked up about it because no one told me. I didn't get to give input. That I don't like the way that is. Pick a thing. And then that discussion that wasn't a decision resulted in people being resistant to whatever the decision was going to go be, right? So that's a lot of analytical psychological process for how to get to a decision. But generally, what we're trying to do is create buy-in in the decision-making process, make sure we're hearing all sides of how it will be impacted, figure out the right way to implement and when to implement. That's another thing in the fire service. Everyone hears a decision's made, they think it's happening tomorrow, but the curve is bigger than that, right? This might be 2 months from now, but the decision's made. In November, we're going to start that process, not today. We've had that happen, right? So we have to
Right.
remember, we got to say the decision's been made, our implementation date is this particular day. So there's just, if you want to do that well, it really, what it does is it just stops a lot of angst over things that haven't or won't happen. And it takes the challenges of the job are challenging enough. What we don't need to do from an admin side of things is put more angst or anxiety on people based on the inability to, like I said, have some follow-up or perspective or some buy-in to the process. So, in our world, we have discussions and we have decisions, and we do, okay, do we decide? Do we come to a decision? Then, yep, the decision, good. Who's going to communicate? When do we implement? And then that's the stuff we start trying to communicate in the decision-making process. Yeah, I hope that's helpful for people.
Yes. Yes. Love it. Love
Good,
it.
good, good.
Love it. Okay. And my last question I always like to ask the guests, but I always, it's always funny to me, especially if you're a chief officer, or the fire chief, because I always like to end with, where would you like to see yourself retiring before, you hang up your hat for the fire service? And you are already fire chief.
Sure.
So, a lot of people aspire to be that, but what's your plan before retirement, or where would you like to see yourself?
Yeah, I'm 51 now. My plan was to retire about 60, 61, maybe at the latest. Like anything, there's a lot of things that have to happen along the way for me to figure that out. Retiring earlier is easy. I could do that could happen too, but I want to make sure what we do is, at least from my perspective here as the fire chief, is leave an organization where the continuity of the organization, the long-term continuity is there, meaning we have people properly prepared. We have people that are learning and growing, getting ready for those next roles and responsibilities. And we had a little fault in the past. And that's okay. Everybody's going to have faults and challenges. That's part of life. But trying to put some of those strategies in place to make sure that the organization that's been here for 135 years will be here for another 135 years in a way that really helps serve people. So that's kind of my hope and intent and some of my driving force into what we do organizationally. I also want to try and find ways to improve the fire service. I'll give you an example. We had a neighboring fire district kind of get a little bit of a black eye in the news, but the community doesn't know that kind of stuff, right? They don't know that fire department versus our fire department. They just see fire department black eye. So I really am looking for trying to find ways to help people in the fire service. I don't know what that looks like, in part because I know that when you become a fire chief, you really think you know what you're doing, and maybe you do for your organization, but there are things that you don't know that you need to know. And building that mechanism to share those things to keep us all, to keep improving the fire service is important to me. And that could be something maybe in, look at it another way. Who are we hiring to go out and serve right now, right? Are we hiring people that really care about their community? Are we hiring people that are just wanting to do it for the schedule? I don't know, pick a thing. It's a great schedule, but I mean, that shouldn't be in my opinion, shouldn't be your driving force. It should be that desire to serve. And I think there's something that if we look at in the hiring process, we will find a lot of really good people that want to serve if we just get that opportunity. So I think, from a fire service perspective, I'd love to find ways to help improve the fire service. What that looks like is the hard part too, is I'm happy to teach when people ask. I'm happy to share ideas and concepts that might benefit other people, but I don't want to push it on other people either. I haven't done, a lot of chief conferences or any of that kind of stuff. I just help share where I can share. And I like to, I don't want to be one of those guys that's like, hey, I'm good because I teach. I just want to be good. And if that helps, I know that I'm happy to teach after that. You know what I mean? So I think that's always my little hang up, because I think we see a lot of people out there that put their self-worth in the fact that they're a teacher in the fire service community. And interestingly enough, when you read some of the background, you're like, I'm not sure if you should be teaching. I don't know about that. You know what I mean? So like, I'm
Right.
not trying to bash on anybody. It's just, it makes me a little apprehensive to be out there and be like, so I'd love to like make the fire service better. I will share with you just a little kind of personal passion, which is I love Colorado, and it is a beautiful state. But what Colorado has become, in some context, is not amazing. And I don't know if that's something that I could do at some point. And I really don't like, I've watched politicians, and I really don't like the political piece of things, but I really love this state and would love to see it brought back to its kind of old luster. And so maybe that's a something I'll do after the fire service. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know what that
No.
looks like. I don't know if you're familiar with Colorado at all, but it used just to be just a beautiful place with no crime. And unfortunately now it's just a,
Now it's yeah. Yeah,
it's
I
just,
mean there's lots of places that have turned into that. And I don't know if it's society. I don't know. I don't know.
I think
But
we could put a lot of figures of what it might be, but I can just tell you that, like, for me personally, I just want to find ways to help, right? And I've got a capacity, a propensity to help people, and I've got a lot of energy, and I love to encourage other people and empower them. And if I can find ways to keep doing that inside our organization, in our little fire community here, in the fire service. And even more than that, then I would look for those ways to do those things. So what that looks like, I'm not sure, but just I guess I know I want to keep giving until that energy expends itself. And so far that just hasn't happened yet. Yeah.
understood. Understood. Chief, man, this has been a fantastic, fantastic interview. I loved hearing, picking your brain and hearing your thoughts and notions. I have to give a shout out to Chief Beeler and Marcos Orozco for making this happen. It's been a long time. I've been every once in a while, I'll send up a text and be like, hey, did you work on it? And Marcos is like, I'm working on it. Chief Beeler is like, I'm working on it.
Yeah.
So we finally got this to happen. I can see why both of them have said what they said about you. I've had personal conversations with Marcos, and you know, when Marcos was going through his transition of trying to find a fire department, he mentioned that, you know, that him and his wife traveled to Colorado a lot. They looked up Brighton, and he was like, from talking to the fire chief and listening to his perspective, and even Chief Beeler said, amazing job. I'm sure they're not blowing smoke up your rear. You definitely have that what I would call the a firefighter chief type mentality. We need more of that in this in the fire service. And I just want to say thank you for spending some time out of your day to do this. It really means a lot.
Yeah, Danny, thank you for having me. Of course, first time I've had a chance to do a podcast. I've really enjoyed the conversation with you. I love that you're doing what you can, right? You're making big impact out there by sharing some things that people need to hear. So keep doing that, and anything I can do to help support that, I'm there for you if you need it. Chief Beeler, Firefighter Roscoe, great people, and thank you for having them on the podcast as well to share some of their ideas. I intentionally didn't listen to theirs. I don't know what they said, so I hope it was good. But I will tell you that what I know about those two people is they will not share anything that's not true.
Right.
I'm sure whatever they shared with you was true and factual. And if they said good things, that makes me happy in the fact that I've been able to help serve them well. And I would only ask them to do that for other people too. So that was my only ask, and that is, it doesn't, none of the stuff we're given belongs to us. We got to give it all away. And so please just keep giving and helping people inside the fire service, in your community, wherever you can reach. And if I can do anything for you after this, or if there's someone else in your community that you're connected with that I can share with, I'm happy to share. I don't know, like anything, I don't claim to know everything about the fire service. I know our little world here, and I've got a little couple pictures from outside. But I would love to see the fire service continue to become a true pillar in that people can look to, the light that they can look to say there is real good in the world, and it's here in the fire service. And what these people are doing for their communities is some of the best work that we'll do for each other as people. And anything I can do to help with that and be those beacons of hope for people that need hope, because we need more of that in the whole country. Then I will help any department or any person that I can to help with that process. So.
Fantastic. Love it. Love the passion, Chief. Like I said, truly appreciate you taking your time to do this.
Awesome. Thanks, Danny. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.